Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily political podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast and I'm joined by Jane Forsyth and Katie Walls. So Theresa May's Hell Week seems to be becoming even more hellish with talk once again of possible leadership challenge. James, do you think there's much of a real threat at this point?
I don't think there's a real threat at this point, but there is more of a threat than I think Downing Street would have expected a week ago. I mean, it is remarkable to think that a week ago, Theresa May was waking up to the best set of front pages she's had since the general election. And now her government seems in a proper crisis. Early this evening, the inner cabinet will meet to discuss the further kind of concessions that Theresa May wants to make to the EU on the backstop. And then that will go to cabinet, full cabinet, next week on Tuesday. And I think now the expectation in Westminster is that there will be one or two resignations over that. When there are those cabinet resignations, that will then spark another round of chatter about whether you're going to see the infamous 48 letters going in calling for a vote of no confidence in Theresa May. Now, I personally still think that that is unlikely. But what I think we are seeing happening here is how hard it is going to be for Theresa May to keep on being Prime Minister after Brexit Day. Because essentially, if you look at the parameters of a deal, you know, if she passes this deal with significant Labour support, that I think will probably be the end of her as Tory leader in anything other than the short term. Or if she passes a deal without DUP support, it'll be very, very hard for her to govern without their support. And lots of Tories might think, well, a new leader might be able to rebuild relations with the DUP. So I think that the problems are mounting up for her. And as someone in government said to me today, a kind of grim inevitability, things that can only get worse.
Katie, the DUP somewhat ambushed the Prime Minister yesterday when they threatened to vote down the budget if she agrees a deal that they don't like. Are they going to just keep causing more problems for her?
Yeah, well, we're given a taste of the perhaps their future plan of action because they abstained on the government's agricultural bill last night. And that didn't cause the government the problem in the end. They still, you know, they didn't suffer a defeat. But I think it was a sign of the fact that, hey, we're flexing some muscle to show you that we can keep doing things like this. There are lots of ways with the current confidence and supply agreement that we can cause you problems. I think there's still lots of talk. I mean, there's an article today in The Telegraph by one of the DUP MPs, Sammy Wilson, who is, I think it's fair to say, one of the more outspoken DUP MPs. So they all speak fairly freely. And he's just making the point that, you know, if this soft touch government, using his words, you know, wants to give in to Brussels concessions and wants to try and, you know, do things the DUP want, they will suffer the consequences and they shouldn't try and call the DUP's bluff. And you keep having conversations with people who will say, you know, well, would they really, you know, call a bluff? Are the DUP going to fold? And I think the clue is basically in their name. Unionist is in the name. If they think Theresa May is signing up to something, which means that they will be treated differently, then Northern Ireland will become slowly more separate from the rest of the UK, will mean that it can't be in these free trade deals, then it's something that is their red line. And I do think that anyone who thinks they're going to fold is a bit misguided here.
It's fascinating what Katie said, because this is essentially what Michel Barnier said to them, which has led to this kind of huge reaction from the DUP, which is, I mean, Downing Street had been sugarcoating the backstop to the DUP, and I mean, Michel Barnier provided a very unvarnished version of it to them. And also, as Katie said, the point he made to them was the more the UK diverges from the EU over time, the more effect the backstop will have. And I think that is, as Katie said, that is what worries the DUP. It's noticeable that Arlene Foster talks about our children in the statement. She worries that 30, 40 years from now, Northern Ireland will seem distinctively less British, and therefore the road to a united Ireland, Northern Ireland will be further on that path, that journey. I think that is what is driving their concerns. And I think, as Katie says, that is so fundamental for them that it's wrong to think that, as someone in government said to me today, that number 10 are thinking about the DUP like cabinet ministers. You know, can they be bought off with a better job or a bit of money or this or that? That's not how they think on this issue.
Katie, what do you make of John Major's comments? He said that Tory rebels threatening May are even worse than his own bastards.
Yeah, I think when it comes to this bastard off, obviously when John Major talked about the bastards, he was referring to three members of his cabinet. But I think when it comes to the Brexiteers that caused trouble in that era, some of those people are still around in Theresa May's, you know, party. I think when you look at her bastards, a lot of them obviously have quit. They're now on the backbench trying to cause her maximum problems. But when it comes to the day-to-day, it does seem that the people who are giving her the biggest headache right now are not actually Boris Johnson or David Davis, who have been huffing and puffing for some time with her checkers, is actually the DUP.
And Katie, what do you make of Mark Pritchard's tweet, which he tweeted this afternoon? Afternoon saying that if a vacancy did arise, the process would not need to take more than 2 working weeks.
Yeah, I think this is one of those tweets which on the surface seemed positive. This is a Tory MP saying, you know, there's lots of loose talk about leadership, but, you know, it seems unlikely to happen. But, however, if it were to happen, I'd just like to point out, purely on a technical point, we could actually get rid of the current Prime Minister and replace him with a shiny new leader in the space of 2 weeks. So don't worry about it. So I think that this is actually going to cause Theresa May more problems than actually be helpful to her. I still think, as James said earlier, it looks unlikely that they'll make such a move. But it's interesting that a Tory MP feels like it is appropriate to go on social media and lay out how the time frame would work if they do want to get rid of leader.
I think, as Kate said, it's obviously an unhelpful intervention from the point of view of the Prime Minister. One member of the party board said to me that, having kind of looked at the rules, they thought if you can't do it by acclamation, which I think would be almost impossible in these circumstances, e.g. the MPs all agree it's going to be one person, there's no need for a contest. Someone on the party board said to me they thought the quickest you could do any contest would be 2 months. And that is one of the things working in her favour, because you take 2 months out of the Brexit process now and you end up in the middle of January and we leave at the end of March.
And just finally, James, what do you make of the story of this transgender prisoner who's been jailed for life after admitting to sexually assaulting 2 women inmates?
I think this is a case that will touch a nerve, because it sums up what many people worry about with this whole transgender debate, which is someone who is transitioning from being a man to being a woman is allowed into a female facility, but they are still, in certain respects of physical strength and things like that, more similar to a man than a woman, and they then take advantage of that to, in this case, commit a crime. And I think this is something that we need to have a kind of public policy debate over, which is, look, it is obviously clear that all people, regardless of whatever orientation or gender they think they are, should be treated with decency and respect. But you do have to balance that out against the kind of rights of other people to be in an area that is a safe place for them to be. And some of these places are presumed to be safe because you are putting people all of one gender in them. If that biological gender division is not being upheld, it does pose certain problems. And I think this is something that, you know, that we need to be, as you can tell from my slightly long and awkward sentences, but we do need to be more comfortable about discussing this, because this is going to be an issue. And at the moment, because no one's quite sure of the language to use, no one's quite sure of what the terms of debate should be, I think that everyone is thinking it might be easier not to talk about it. But in the long run, it will not be easier not to talk about it, because that will lead to a situation where the public starts saying, how on earth did that happen? And I think that's a dangerous situation to get to.
Yeah, and at the moment, when this individual appeared by video link in the court, that's now from a male prison. But before, that person was in a female prison. So I think there's still the question of, you know, in these situations, where is the best place for that person to go? There's clearly reasons why a women's prison doesn't feel suitable, but they probably have their own view that is still where they'd rather be.
Thank you, Katie, and thank you, James. And just a reminder, this podcast is called Coffee House Shots. If you like it, please let us know on the iTunes store. We always like to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and do join us again tomorrow.